to kill you, as I did your mate. He died begging. I would like to hear those same words from you. Smell your surrender. Quill paused. Then, of course, I will kill you.
In the dead of night, Trillet's people delivered the documents Obi-Wan had requested. Between those and the official records, Snoil had access to enough information to keep a research staff busy for years. They didn't have years. He absorbed, scanned, noted, summoned up abstracts, and worked well into the night. Snoil crawled into his bedroom and was not seen again for 10 hours, when he appeared in the doorway with an enormous smile splitting his face. "Dulb?" Obi-Wan asked. Snoil was radiant.
"Obi-Wan!"
he called.
"Obi-Wan! While I slept, the two halves of my brain talked to each other. I found it!"
"Found what?"
"Look here,"
he said, feverish with excitement.
"In this document, executives of Acesta Cybernetics boast about the fact that the land was purchased with synth stones. They actually laugh at the ignorant aboriginals."
"And?"
"Technically, synth stones represent counterfeit money."
Snoil's eyes gleamed.
"Follow me here, Obi-Wan. Cesta Cybernetics was a licensed subsidiary of the prison. The prison was constructed and operated under a Republic contract."
"Yes, and?"
"Obi-Wan!"
Snoil said in exasperation.
"Cesta Cybernetics was at that point a representative of the Republic, held to the same standards as any ambassador. A purchase made with counterfeit currency is no purchase at all. This nullifies the original sale. The land beneath every factory on Cestus still belongs to the Hive."
There was a knock on the door. Chipple the driver stood in the entrance, his secondary hands extending a data disc.
"Clients say play this."
Obi-Wan inserted the disc in his astromech and waited a moment as the image field was generated. Gamai Duras appeared in the air before them.
"Things have come to a head, and my leadership of the Hive Council is under attack. There is no one else I can trust, and I ask you that you come to my quarters where we can speak in greater privacy. My condition is dire."
Duras kept an apartment in the penthouse section of Chicatlik. A servant admitted Obi-Wan to the luxurious accommodations. The inside of her apartment was a blend of technology and traditional Jating chewed Duracrete architecture. Obi-Wan followed Duras into her kitchen. She said,
"I am being forced to fight Quill tonight. I've heard of the Jedi. You are said to be the greatest fighters in the galaxy. Can you teach me to fight?"
Obi-Wan bowed his head. "I'm sorry. There is no time.
I had hoped this day would never arrive. So, I knew it was a foolish hope," she said. "Still, I had to try. Would you stay, please, and dine with me? Please?"
She was shaking so piteously that he couldn't deny her. She served him what she called her death meal, a last ritual act. She kept glancing at the chrono, and he knew her time was drawing near.
"I cannot face Quill in the arena just to be slaughtered publicly. I am afraid of what I might do. I might beg and disgrace my lineage. Better for me to die tonight."
She smiled wanly.
"There is a saying among my people. Death is darkness. The children are safe. It means to have courage."
A thought occurred to Obi-Wan. "What happens if both you and Quill die?" he asked.
"Then the council would be free to make its own decisions. Without Quill, I believe they would be more reasonable."
"Then I have the answer for you," Obi-Wan said.
"The answer is in your death meal."
"What?" "Listen to me," he said, and bent close.
"I have the answer, if you have the courage."
Their arena was a circle of groomed sand 20 meters in diameter. Radiating contempt, Quill began as Duras expected, strutting and boasting. He made short, lightning stinger thrusts, and instead of responding with parry or flight, Duras closed her eyes, folding together the fingers of her primary and secondary hands. "This is what you do," Obi-Wan had said. "Close your eyes. Think that you are preparing your death meal, and be calm. When he stings you, the instant you feel his stinger, sting him. Do not try to survive. Go as one already dead." Quill approached her, and she merely waited. He turned this way and that, trying to frighten her. Nothing he tried worked. "There is a secret to the warrior arts," Obi-Wan had said. "It is the willingness to trade lives with your enemy, to never fight for anything you would not die for. Those who fight for glory, or gold, or power, stand on shifting sand, not the bedrock of true courage. Fight for your people. Fight for your mate. For you, dying means winning. The arena is not a circle of sand. The arena is your heart." Quill leapt and pranced and shook his stinger. He hissed and circled and made fearsome faces. And through it all, Gamai Duras merely stood, waiting to share death with him. At last Quill stopped, stupefied. For the first time, his mask of confidence cracking. Beneath was fear. Gamai Duras stood, eyes closed, waiting. Quill's mouth quivered, and he lowered his eyes to the sand.
I concede, he said, radiating hatred.
The eldest Jating on the council stood and spoke.
Gamai Duras is the winner. Kaeza Quill must yield his seat.
Gamai Duras drew herself up to full height, folding the fingers of primary and secondary hands formally.
My peers and elders, she said. My dear friend Master Kenobi has told me an astonishing thing. For centuries we have known that our ancestors were cheated out of their land, land purchased with worthless baubles we believed were legal tender. Master Kenobi brought a barrister with him from Coruscant, a Vipit who knows their laws well. And according to the central authority, if we should choose to press our suit, we can destroy Cestus Cybernetics. If we own the land beneath their factories, we can charge them whatever we wish for land usage, possibly even take the facilities themselves.
What?
The council's eldest said.
Is this truth?
Quill sputtered.
You would do nothing except destroy the planet! Destroy Cestus Cybernetics, and you destroy our economy!
The elder looked at Quill with contempt.
The Hive was here before Cestus Cybernetics. It is not the Hive that will suffer if this company changes hands, or even if it dies. It will be those who have sold themselves to offworlders for a promise of power.
But my lords, Duras said, I have obligations to the offworlders, people who came to Cestus with skills and heart and wanted only to build a life here. We cannot use this opportunity to destroy. We must use it to build and heal.
The elders nodded, as if pleased by her empathy. Quill quivered.
You have won nothing, Duras. I will block you, I swear. Regardless of what you think you have, what you think you know, this isn't over yet.
He stormed out, humiliated and enraged. Obi-Wan entered Trillet's pit, breathing shallowly to limit the effects of the noxious atmosphere. And yet, there was something in the air that made him want to breathe more deeply. That scent, he said.
Scent?
Trillet asked.
Yes, bantha musk and something else, used as a body scent by certain five family females, or...
He could feel the gears turning in his head. For some reason he had felt off-balance since first arriving on Cestus, in the city, at the ball in the chambers, here in Trillet's chambers, at the cantina. Was there a connecting thread, or was he just tired?
Trillet's mouth twisted.
Well, you've caught me.
A vile conspiratorial smile.
I do have a few friends among the upper class. I hope you can keep a secret.
Of course. Yes, surely that is it. Perhaps I caught the scent at the ball. Now, Obi-Wan exhaled, centering himself. This is what I wish of you. Information.
On?
The subterranean transit system. I assume you can provide?
Of course.
A beam of light projected from Trillet's chair. She made a few brief hand passes through it, and a web of nodes and moving lines materialized. Obi-Wan walked into the middle of it and concentrated. Now, for the first time in days, he felt completely immersed in his plan. Perhaps, after all, his disturbance was mere nerves. From the very beginning, the pattern had been set. Representatives of the five families traveled to the central palace for the day's round of negotiations, conversations, and arguments. Some arrived by private air car or rail car. About a third traveled in a secure private shuttle on the Magcar system using the subterranean network beneath Chicatlik. It was the city's most secure transportation and had never been breached, even during the uprisings that birthed Desert Wind. Today, Lord and Lady Porten, Debekin the Younger, and Quill took the underground Magcar. They felt the sound before they heard it. A dull impact on the Magcar's roof, a juddering as it changed direction. The tunnel walls outside the car blurred past, but it was the same blur that they had seen for years. The same strata of rocks that led between their private residences and the palace. Now, even though they still blurred, there was a subtle difference enough to disturb them. And the direction had changed.
What is this?
Lord Porten raised his voice.
Conductor!
The droid at the front of the car turned to him, metallic face expressionless.
I am sorry, but my controls have been overridden by an unknown source.
Contact the security forces!
I am sorry. I must inform you that the entire car is surrounded by some kind of interference field.
Where are they taking us? Debekin asked.
We have taken one of the obsolete tunnel systems and are currently being shunted onto a mine track. I project that our probable destination, based upon information dealing with other kidnap-murder scenarios...
Murder!
Lady Porten shrieked.
I regret to inform you that there is approximately a 13% chance that the intent of this action is, ultimately, the death of every person in this car.
The five family executives glanced around at each other, mouths quivering in shock. The car went a bit farther, made a sharp right turn. It stopped, and then slowly, inexorably, they felt it sink beneath them. Then the car stopped moving completely. Now they could hear footsteps on the roof. Their eyes following them as one portentous thud at a time, they moved back to the rear and then stopped. They glanced at each other, and Quill had opened his mouth to speak, when a figure with thick ropes of tentacle wriggling from his head swung lightly down and smashed through the roof's plastine partition. A Nautilin! But what did he want? He was empty-handed, but there was a handle tucked into his belt, and Debekin knew instantly that it represented a threat of some kind.
Who are you?
Quill spluttered.
My name is Nemonis. Greetings from Count Dooku,
the Nautilin said.
What do you want?
You seek to change a bargain,
the intruder said.
What? What are you talking about?
You must learn that there is no place you can hide. A deal was struck. Those who renegotiate price may find other matters transformed as well.
My master promised to keep you out of the war, that you would not be involved.
That can change, my friends. That can all change.
Young Debekin glanced at the others, nearing panic now.
No! We have kept our pledges to you! All of them!
The intruder sneered.
Then why have you raised your prices, threatened to withhold shipment without further credits?
There was a moment of relief as they glanced at each other. For a moment they had feared that he knew of the negotiations with the Jedi Kenobi. No, this was something completely different. Cestus Cybernetics demand for a 10% surcharge. It is the war! The war!
Debakin leaned closer.
Supply lines have been cut.
The intruder was unimpressed.
You cannot be trusted.
Quill was using his secondary hands to reach stealthily for the little holdout blaster always attached to his wallet.
How can you say that? Our dealings with you have placed Cestus in jeopardy with the Republic. We would not betray you. If we did, we would have no one.
The intruder's back was to Quill. The blaster was almost in hand. For the first time, the intruder seemed to change expressions.
Your families need a lesson. The best I can imagine is one written in blood.
Quill's blaster was out and moving to the level, its tiny gleaming barrel rising to sight at the intruder's back. But without turning, the intruder's hand flickered. The gleaming handle at his belt blurred. Something that looked like a coil of glowing wire suddenly flexed, lashing backward toward Quill's blaster. 3 meters long it was, and thin as a thread, wrapping around the barrel. With the slightest twist of the intruder's wrist, the blaster was sliced in half, the grip suddenly glowing white hot. Quill dropped the blaster, howling from singed fingers, and thrust them into his mouth, sucking and nursing them.
Now then, Kit Fisto smiled grimly. Shall we negotiate?
By the time Obi-Wan arrived at the palace, the halls were in an uproar. He was hustled into Gamai Duras's presence to see the regal Jating hunched in her seat, listening to the words of a round, short-legged Tzitza with a very worried expression. Duras glanced up, an expression of surprise, and then tears of gratitude overflowing her faceted eyes.
Master Jedi, she said. Obi-Wan, I am afraid we have an emergency. The five families should have been here an hour ago. Their private car seems to have disappeared.
Disappeared? Obi-Wan managed to conceal the pleasure in his voice. How is that possible? The entire planet is honeycombed with tunnels. Many of them are unmapped. And as yet you have received no communication.
None, she said.
Master Jedi, have you a plan?
Tell your security people not to shoot until they've made an identification, Obi-Wan murmured.
What are you going to do?
Obi-Wan paused for dramatic effect and then replied,
Something drastic.
For more than an hour after the Magcar's power had been cut and it had settled to the shaft floor, the mood in the diverted car continued to deteriorate. The captured leaders of the five families had watched with alarm as their solitary kidnapper was joined by three ruffians dressed in desert wind khakis.
What do you intend to do with us?
Lady Porten whispered.
Wait, a masked desert wind soldier replied. You'll see.
One man patrolled outside the car, leaving two within it with the Nautilin. Young Debakin watched the one outside. He walked back and forth around the car, and then he was gone. For a moment, there was confusion, and then the figure reappeared. Only, was it the same person? Had he been mistaken, or had the car's tinted windows revealed some kind of brief and violent struggle? Hope was a luxury they dared not indulge in. And yet...
And now, the taller of the Desert Wind ruffians began.
He never had a chance to finish the words. A black noose dropped down under his chin. The cord tightened, and the man was hauled up through an emergency door in the car's roof, kicking and screaming, scrabbling at his neck with hooked fingers. Instantly, the Nautilin kidnapper wheeled, snarling. Cloak fluttering around him like the plumage of some bird of prey, Obi-Wan Kenobi dropped down into the car. The tan-clad Desert Wind soldier was the first to reach him, and therefore, the first to go down in a brief flicker of a lightsaber. He stumbled back, the shoulder of his jacket smoking and spitting sparks.
Jedi!
The Nautilin snarled. Obi-Wan's eyes narrowed to slits.
Nemonis, not the first time you've tried blood diplomacy.
Nor the last,
the Nautilin growled.
But it is the last time I'll tolerate your meddling.
Without another word, the two leapt toward each other, and the fight was on. As long as they lived, the men and women in that car would remember the next few moments. The Nautilin wielded his glowing whip in a sinuous blur, with demonic accuracy. It arced up and around, flexing and coiling like a living thing. Wherever it went, and whatever he did, the Jedi was there first. Master Kenobi was the first to penetrate the other's guard, such that the light whip was barely able to enmesh the glowing energy blade in time to deflect. The cloth along the Nautilin's arm flared with brief, intense heat. The Nautilin snarled, and fear showed in his face. The Jedi was winning! In another engagement, two at the most, Master Kenobi would have solved the light whip's riddle and go for the kill. The Nautilin lashed this way and that, as if gathering his energies for renewed aggression. Then, with a single, smooth, eye-baffling motion, he scooped up the wounded Desert Wind soldier as if he were a mere child. The Nautilin bounded up through the roof and was gone. They heard his footsteps pattering down the tunnel. And then, nothing. Master Kenobi turned to them, his face beginning to relax back from its battle mask. "Are you hurt?" he asked. Quill was reduced to mere babbling.
"No! That was amazing! I'd always heard stories of the Jedi, but never! I just want to say thank you! Thank you so much!"
The rescued hostages gave a ragged cheer, even Quill, whose faceted eyes shone with awe. Young Devakin tugged at their savior's robes.
"Master Jedi," he asked, "how can I repay you?"
The Jedi smiled grimly.
"Tell your father to remember his duty," he said.
Sheikah Tull had landed Spindragon a safe distance away, and walked into camp under a burgeoning double moon. She found Nate leaning back against a rock, lost in his own thoughts. He smiled and raised a cup of Sestian spore mead as he saw her. "What do we celebrate?" she asked, suspecting that she already knew the answer.
"A little operation that went even better than expected. And no, no one is dead."
She searched his face. "Disappointed?"
He glared at her. "Absolutely. I was hoping for human barbecue tonight."
She leaned back against the rock with him.
"I heard things on the scanner."
"Really?" he asked. "What did they say?"
"Oh, something about a group of 5 family types being kidnapped and then rescued."
"Kidnapped? Rescued?" he said, wide-eyed. "Goodness, sounds exciting."
He must have noticed the thoughtful frown on her face and misinterpreted its meaning a bit.
"So," he said, "I get the sense that you don't approve of our mission."
"That wasn't what I was thinking."
"But you don't. Why do you help us?"
"Not voluntarily."
"Then why? What leverage does someone have?"
Her answering laugh was a bit tighter than she'd intended.
"Somewhere on Coruscant is a computer file listing every indiscretion ever committed in the galaxy. There was a need, my name came up, and doing a favor is better than spending a decade on a work planet."
"And your name is on this list?"
She nodded. "You're a quick study."
"I believe that's called sarcasm."
"Ooh," she squealed. "More human by the minute. Next, we try irony."
He scowled ferociously and she laughed.
"So, what did you do?"
"My youngest sister joined a religious sect under Von IV. When they refused to pay taxes, Coruscant slapped an embargo on them. When a plague struck the colony, they were going to die. Every woman, man, and child. No one would do a thing. So..."
He nodded, understanding.
"So you got them their medicine."
"And your sister?"
She brightened. "Raising a squalling brood of brats somewhere in the Outer Rim. I'd do it all over again."
"Even though it brought you here?"
"Even though."
"I notice you spend more time talking to me than my brothers," he said. "Why is that?"
"You hold my interest."
"Why?"
"I don't know," she said honestly. "Perhaps because you are the only one trained for command. That makes you more like Django."
"They say he was a loner."
"Yes," she said, "but a natural leader, too."
At other times he could be invisible. As I understand, quite a few people learn to their brief and painful regret. Nate gave a hard, flat chuckle. Yes, indeed. But if he wanted, when he entered a room, every head would turn. She paused a beat. Especially mine. Her voice grew softer. But that was all so long ago. I was 18 years old, and Django was 25. Was he a bounty hunter then? She closed her eyes, dredging up old memories. I think he was in transition. He'd only been free maybe 2 years, since the Mandalorians were wiped out. I met him in the Meridian sector. He'd lost his armor somehow and was searching for it. A ruminative smile. We had just about a year together. Then things got dangerous. We were raided by space pirates. Our ship got blown from the sky, and in the middle of a really nasty space battle, we were forced to take separate evacuation pods. I never saw him again. She paused. I heard he survived and got his armor back. I don't know if he looked for me. Sheikah shrugged. Life is like that sometimes. Then she chuckled, and he drew back slightly and looked at her in puzzlement.
Why do you laugh?
You do remind me of Django. He always locked his emotions away. But I can remember times when he let them out of their cage. Such as? If you're lucky, I might tell you sometime. She took his hand. Come, I'd like to show you something.
I have to be available.
You said you were off duty. Are you confined to base?
No. He stopped. If I'm called, I would need to be back within 20 minutes. Can you guarantee that?
She calculated distance and velocities in her head. Yes. 5 minutes of scrambling over broken rock took them the spin dragon. As he strapped in, Sheikah swiftly completed her pre-departure checklist and lifted off. Nate watched as she took him into a saw-toothed stretch of hills, and then set them down again gently, not 18 minutes after they left the camp. The camp was built into the hillsides, several different mine openings suggesting both natural and artificial breaches in the surface. As she landed, a dozen off-worlders and two Jiting emerged to meet them. All grinned, nodded, or waved at them in greeting.
What is this place?
They are my extended family, she said. Not by birth, by choice.
Is this where you live?
She smiled. No. But my home is a lot like this. A southern wind nipping at their backs, Sheikah led Nate up a worn, dusty hillside trail into the mouth of one of the tunnels. Within was a large communal area lit by glowing fungi arrayed along the walls, nurtured with liquid nutrients trickling from a pipe rigging. The fungi rippled in a luminescent rainbow. When he brought his hand close to a bank of it, his skin tingled. Most places on Cestus, the off-worlders pretty much dominate the Jiting, consider them primitive, even though they give lip service to respect. But there are a few little enclaves like this one, where we actually try to learn from them. They have a lot to offer, really, if we just give them a chance. A variety of human and other off-worlder children ran hither and thither with their little Jiting friends, burning energy like exploding stars, flooding the entire cave with their exuberance. The day's major work had ended, but some of the adults were still fixing tools, laughing and joking in easy camaraderie. What do you think? Sheikah asked. He strove to compose an answer both accurate and in alignment with his values and feelings. This seems a good life, an easy life, not a soldier's life. It is not for me. Nate had assumed that she would accept such an answer at face value. But instead, Sheikah bristled. You think this is easier? Raising children, loving, hoping. You? A sharp, hard bark of laughter. You're surrounded by the replaceable. Ships, equipment, people. A modular world. A piece breaks, replace it. You never leave home without expecting to die. What do you think it's like to actually care if your children survive? To care. What do you think the universe looks like to someone who cares?
How strong would someone have to be just to preserve hope?
Her outburst knocked him back on his emotional heels.
Perhaps, I see what you were saying.
She continued on as if she had prepared this speech for days.
And how much strength do you think it requires to keep your spirits high when everything you've spent a lifetime building, that your parents and grandparents spent a lifetime building, can be destroyed by the decision of someone too far away to touch?
She paused a moment. And men like you. It was his turn to bristle. Men like me protect you from other men like you. No, men like me don't start the wars. We just die in them. We don't expect any praise for it, no parades. No one knows our names. In fact, by your standards, we have no names at all.
Nate, no. Is that what you wanted to hear?
Well, it's true. We don't have names. And no one will ever know who we are. But we do. We always do. We're the Grand Army of the Republic.
Sheikah shook her head. Nate, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to judge you.
I haven't had your choices. Every step of my life I've been told what to do.
Yes, she said. He took a step closer, looking down on her dark, lovely face.
And what do you know? We both ended up in the same place.
She managed a rueful smile, said, "Come on," and led him back out of the cave. The two of them sat on a hillside, watching the moons and listening to the happy sounds. "Do troopers ever have real names?" she asked.
"Rarely. Would you mind if I gave you one?"
She was staring at him with such sincere intensity that he almost laughed, but couldn't. The whole thing was amusing, really.
"What name did you have in mind?"
"I was thinking Jango Tat," she said quietly.
"Mandalorian for Jango's brother." He laughed.
"Sure," he said. "If that makes it easier, fine."
Jango Tat, he thought. Jango's brother. A smile.
"That I am."
Black oily smoke curled from the transport's ruptured belly and boiled to the clouds. Hands bound behind their backs, its crew had begun their 20-kilometer trek back to Chicatlic. The message they carried would be heard loud and clear.
"Chaos is coming."
"It goes well?"
asked the newly christened Jango Tat.
"Well enough,"
Kit Fister said, gazing through his electro-binoculars.
"We strike, they grab at shadows, and we sever their limbs. Soon the five families will pray for order and safety."
"You don't sound totally pleased, sir."
"I'm not comfortable with such deception, even though I admit its value."
"May I say, sir, that such non-conventional warfare saves lives?"
The general put the electro-binoculars away.
"Well, if a soldier of the Republic can find such a goal admirable, can a Jedi do less?"
"Sir?"
Jango Tat looked to either side swiftly, saw that they were alone, and lowered his voice.
"Please don't laugh at me."
The Nautilan shook his head gravely.
"Never.
I'm thinking of taking a name." General Fisto's teeth gleamed.
"I've heard that some do. What name are you thinking?"
"Be careful," he warned.
"Names can be powerful."
The trooper nodded.
"So, a friend suggested Jango Tat, brother of Jango. Would that be a good thing?"
Kit Fisto did him the respect of genuinely pondering the question. Then, after almost a minute, he answered.
"Jango was a man of great strengths, a worthy foe. I would be proud to have his namesake at my side."
He slapped the trooper's shoulder.
"Jango Tat."
The council chambers had been locked in verbal turmoil for long hours when Obi-Wan entered. He very nearly smiled. Since the subterranean kidnapping and battle, the major subject of conversation was not whether they should acquiesce to the Republic's request, but rather how they could most swiftly comply. Yes, I was called. Snoyle sat at the circular conference table across from the executives.
We've had a breakthrough. They've decided to meet the Chancellor's terms.
Excellent. The immense room was filled wall to circular wall with representatives of the five families. They added signatures and thumbprints on the touchscreens for instant upload to legal computers all over Cestus, and from there broadcast to Coruscant for instant verification. One of Duris's lawyers put a data pad in front of Obi-Wan. And now, Master Kenobi, we need your signature on the following documents. Suddenly, and without formal announcement, Quill entered the chamber, waving a rectangular holocard above his head, as if it contained the secrets of the universe. His faceted eyes gleamed.
Wait! Hold the proceedings! Do not thumb that holodock!
Duris stared at Quill with suspicion. What is the meaning of this?
Better we ask the Jedi the meaning of this.
He placed the card in a data pad, smirking with triumph. An instantly recognizable image sprang into the air. It was not taken from a standard security cam. Those had all been disabled down in the tunnels. It was rather an image taken by some unseen person who had reached the site even before Kenobi had arrived. Obi-Wan's gut churned sourly. How had this happened? Floating on the player's projection field was the image of a Desert Wind fighter. A battle ensued between Jedi and Rebel, revealed very clearly from this angle to be a mockery, a fraud, with a lightsaber passing a quarter meter broad of the target. The mood in the room had grown frigid. No one made a sound. This was disaster beyond belief. The mission was utterly compromised, had perhaps been from the beginning.
I understand now, Lady Portense said, how the Jedi have attained their impressive reputations.
Gemai Duris stood, her secondary arms fidgeting nervously, her golden flesh gone pale with rage.
You will leave immediately, she said. I trusted you. Trusted.
Then Duris collected herself. Go, Obi-Wan Kenobi. While you can. No honor guard appeared at the spaceport to see Obi-Wan and Duleb Snoyle away. Obi-Wan walked up the landing ramp into the Republic transport ship. Behind him, Snoyle shuffled along with only the slightest of slime trails on the track.
Obi-Wan, what happened?
I am not certain, my friend, he said. And as the door closed behind him, he strapped himself in. He turned to the lawyer. I don't know, but I felt something. From the beginning, there have been factors beyond my understanding. I have missed something, and that blunder made all the difference.
Oh, dear! All of that planning and work! I never dreamed things could go so wrong!
Obi-Wan shook his head, but said nothing. As soon as Zutu made the basic preparations, the ship lifted off. As it rose, Obi-Wan turned to Snoyle. I've made my decision, he said. It is no longer safe for you, Ancestus. You will go, but I must stay. My job here isn't finished. I'm going to join Master Fisto. Snoyle's eye stalks trembled with amazement as the Jedi began a checklist of preparations for jettisoning an escape pod. Obi-Wan turned to Zutu and gripped his shoulder. Get him home safely.
Yes, sir.
And so saying, Obi-Wan pressed a series of switches and the capsule sealed. It seemed to sink into the wall behind it. A moment later, there was a light shush sound and the Jedi was gone. Duleb Snoyle watched the display as their ship rose, freeing itself of Cestus's gravitational pull. Once free, it paused as the nav computers plotted their jump to hyperspace. He already missed his friend Obi-Wan and was formulating an explanation to the Chancellor. Zutu's voice disturbed his reverie.
Sir, we may have a problem.
There was an edge of something Snoyle understood all too well in that voice. Controlled panic. From a point between Cestus's two moons, a small ship approached them, bearing in like a bird of prey. A war drone. A hunter killer. The new ship fired a probe droid at them.
I've commenced evasive maneuvers, but I don't know. Sir, I would suggest that you follow General Kenobi's example and evacuate.
The ship began to make looping evasive maneuvers. More probe droids must have joined the first, because they rocked and juddered with blasts as Zutu did his best.
I can't make you go, sir. But in a moment, I'll jettison the remaining escape pods in an attempt to distract the missile.
Listening to Zutu's machine-like calm somehow penetrated Snoyle's defensive mechanisms, as even the explosions had not. No escape pods. He broke.
No! No! Wait for me!
Pushing himself to emergency speed, Snoyle moved as rapidly as a human being might stroll, wedging himself into the escape capsule. He pushed the automatic sequence button. Crash foam billowed up around him, and sight was lost. Then things went black as his pod sank back into and through the ship's walls. He felt a rush, and then a jolt, followed by sudden deep quiet. Then a sensation of floating. Snoyle had no control at all. Everything was managed by the automatic emergency program. A screen opened up before his eyes, some kind of computerized display showing the exterior of the ship as six other escape pods burst free. Two of them attracted probe droids away from Snoyle as he plummeted toward the atmosphere, but the screen showed the ship evading one, two, three of the droids, and he began to feel more optimistic. Then the screen went very, very bright. When the light dimmed, only smoke and debris remained. Zutu and the ship were gone, destroyed. Then suddenly, there was nothing but silence from outside. To his wonder, he realized that he had survived the storm. Now, there was just the little matter of the landing. Far below him and to the west, Obi-Wan Kenobi rolled his escape pod into shadows and heaped sand and rocks atop it. Instinct made him gaze up at the sky, where streaks of red and white blossomed against the clouds. He frowned, trying to make out the shapes, and then recognized them for what they were. Shattered chunks of the ship, re-entering the atmosphere. Then he saw the purple glow of repulsor fire and relaxed just a bit. Someone had escaped the ship, and Snoyle was nothing if not lucky. There was more than a chance that his old friend remained alive. Obi-Wan disguised his distress signal with narrow-burst encoded messages. Less than 2 hours later, Fak Thal Jing and Serdi reached him with a dozen recruits. He sent half of them after Snoyle and followed the others back to camp, where he rejoined Kit Fisto and clone troopers. "The least of our problems," Obi-Wan concluded, "is that negotiations with Gamai Duras and the leadership of Sestis have failed." "I agree," Kit said. His black eyes gleamed. "There are other forces at play here. From the beginning, we have been manipulated." Obi-Wan stood, slapping his palms against his legs. "The situation has changed," he said. "Our resources have changed, and the nature of our adversaries has changed. Gentle people," he scanned the assembled, "an unknown person or persons destroyed our transport ship and killed one of your brothers. This was an unspeakable act, and must be addressed as such." For hours, Gamai Duras had pored over her advisor's reports and suggestions, seeking to better understand her current position. The Republic had attempted to influence her decisions by deception. The Jedi had won her the leadership of the Hive Council, had given her a piece of information that could destroy Sestis Cybernetics or offer her people a new beginning. But by perpetrating a fraud, Obi-Wan had plunged her into a nightmare. She could not support the Jedi or accept his support. The information in her hands could not be used to manipulate Sestis Cybernetics. Without support from the Republic, the information would do little save ensure her own assassination. Her assistant Sharshar rolled into the room, blue skin gleaming splotchily in alarm.
"Regent Duras," she cried, "we have terrible news."
Sharshar extruded an arm and punched a code into the machine, waving her stubby hands through the reading stream until the images changed.
This just came through a minute ago.
The view was from orbit. They watched Obi-Wan's ship rising up through the atmosphere. Something appeared from the direction of a moon. It was black and configured strangely, and Duris thought her eyes deceived her. It appeared from nowhere, swooped out of frame until another satellite caught it. And then it and the Jedi ship were both in the viewing field at the same time. The black ship spat something out toward the Jedi ship, which promptly commenced corkscrewing maneuvers.
Who is in the escape pod? Gamai asked.
Let me see.
Her assistant manipulated the field.
Not much shielding on a pod. We might be able to... Ah, not human. It was the Vipit Barrister.
Then the Jedi is still piloting the ship?
Perhaps, and...
Suddenly, the entire visual field flooded with light, enough to wash the shadows from the room and temporarily render them all dazed and nearly blind.
What was that?
Duris asked, instantly comprehending the horrid absurdity of the question.
Some unknown force or person had destroyed the Republican ship, and with it, the Jedi, personally appointed by Supreme Chancellor Palpatine to negotiate with Sestus.
With anarchists attacking on multiple fronts, there was little time for rest in Chicat Lick. The attacks were always carried out with laser precision, and inevitably involved minimal structural damage and no loss of life. Still, with every strike, an industrial complex was damaged, production slowed or stopped. Mines were rendered too dangerous for workers to enter. Vehicles were sabotaged, and security forces were humiliated and enraged. And behind it all, behind every mark on the map that meant another blown bridge, another crippled skyport, another central processing bystation rendered useless, Duris thought she sensed the mind of Obi-Wan Kenobi. Brilliant, ferocious, tactically diverse, and respectful of life in all its forms. Could the Jedi still be alive? If the majority of production loci were jammed, if those critical production lines were slow to a crawl, her hands would be tied. She would have to either sue for peace or call in Confederacy forces to protect their interests, throwing Sestus onto the path of destruction. During those days, the regent slept little. Then, in the middle of the night, Sharshar's cries roused her from uneasy dreams.
"We've trapped Desert Wind!" she called.
Obi-Wan Kenobi was pinned down in a bunker at the rock-tumbled edge of Kibo Lake, just outside the power station's white Duracrete dome. The clone troopers were still disguised as Desert Wind fighters. Even though Obi-Wan knew that the incriminating holovid existed, if there were no additional witnesses and no obvious clone trooper involvement, it would be easier for Coruscant to deny allegations. Kibo Lake's 50-kilometer-wide volcanic crater was the fourth largest on the planet. Active vents at the bottom transformed this, one of Sestus's largest bodies of groundwater, into a hypermineralized geothermal soup pot, home to a collection of odd primitive aquatic forms and a power source for many of the outlying mines. The geothermal stations tapped those volcanic vents, concentrating the heat and ultimately powering a series of steam turbines. The power was sold in a dozen forms planet-wide. Both stealth and courage had been required to move into position for the assault. Explosive charges had been carefully placed, guards neutralized without fatality. If all had gone well, they would have faded back into the desert an hour before the first explosion's false dawn illuminated the night sky. It was not to be.
"We're surrounded!"
Thak Valjing hissed. "No," Obi-Wan said calmly. Valjing stuck his head up and was immediately driven back by accurate blaster fire. "We're pinned," Obi-Wan corrected. "Jango Tat."
"Yes, sir."
"I want you to draw them for me. I'll provide covering fire." Jango Tat knelt down as Obi-Wan traced in the dust with his fingertip. The trooper grasped the implications instantly. Obi-Wan and his forces began a flurry of counterblasting that temporarily tied down the guards crouching just beyond the dome. Taking that opportunity, Jango Tat dashed out from the hiding place
and firing by instinct, managed to hit one of the security guards on the fly. A fatality. No way around it now. Obi-Wan's thoughts were interrupted as Jango-Tat dashed from the side and zigzagged across the wharf, drawing a blistering stream of fire. Blaster bolts ripped around his feet as Jango-Tat made a high, clean dive into the volcanic pit. Obi-Wan flinched. That water had to be hot. Obi-Wan aimed carefully and blew a hole in the heat condenser coil. Live steam billowed from the burst coil, and the security men screamed.